Welcome to Hashtag with Nagbuzi Chiwanuka. This is the place where we help you unravel social constructs, discuss self-development in line with mental health, and everything in between that directly or indirectly affects us in the millennial world around us. If you're hearing my voice for the first time and are the kind of person who is not scared of being a better version of yourself, even if it requires you to contradict who you were 24 hours ago, consider this your virtual home. I am your host, Nagbuzi Chiwanuka, a lawyer, founder, stroke team lead of Equate Foundation, an addict and lover of insightful conversations, and a professional unraveler of social constructs. So, Sunday, the 10th of October, was Mental Health Day, and in commemoration of the day, we saw it fit to have the soft-spoken teacher and healer Oburungi Burizayo in this reflectional episode. She gets to share with us her life story, plus a snippet of how her mental health was affected and everything in between. She went on to break down what it's like when one is not mentally healthy. Her graceful speech and all the gems she came with require your full attention. So let's get into it. Buiza, welcome to Hashtag with Nagbuzi Chiwanuka.
Hi, Nagbuzi. I'm really happy to be here.
I'm honored. I am the one who is honored to host you.
You're very kind.
No, I'm supposed to be saying this. You're the kind one. What's kindness? What's kind about me hosting you?
Your kind words, I mean.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. So, Buiza, tell us help us understand who Buiza is. Help our listeners know who is on set.
My name is Buiza Oburungi Burizayo, which is a name that I just recently acquired.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm in the process of legally amending my name to that from previously Desire Karachiri to this, which was my given name and my father's name that I felt did not quite fit who I've become self-identified adult. So I decided to take a name that I felt connected with me more and that whose meaning I believed in, which is Oburungi Burizayo, my paternal grandmother's name.
What does Oburungi Burizayo, oh my goodness, I managed to pronounce it. What does Oburungi, it is a sentence, especially with the pronunciation, I want to be careful not to say it the Luganda way.
Yeah.
So what does Oburungi Burizayo mean?
Oburungi Burizayo means that goodness extends or perpetuates or expands. If you do good in the world, good will come back to you.
Oh, going as far as karma. The good, the positiveness, not the karma that most people talk about.
I'm a very spiritual person. I believe in the forces of the universe and karma is one of them.
So, what did you want to be while growing up?
I wanted to be a nurse. Growing up, I took care of everyone. I still do, even as an adult.
A nurse?
Yeah. I didn't like to see people unwell.
You're the first person. Like, I've not heard someone say, I wanted to be a nurse. You'd hear people say, doctor.
Oh.
Yeah. No one, by the way, I've actually noticed that even the people that were giving us options to choose from while growing up, they'll be like, so you want to be a doctor? No one mentions not. That's unfair.
I think nurses are underrated.
They really are.
I think people who put people back together should be celebrated, and nurses do a brilliant job at that.
Especially
doing the work that most people are afraid to do. Touching our wounds. Stitching our bodies. Nurses are underrated.
And meanwhile, when you were really into the field, you realize they do more than the doctors.
I don't know.
No, I'm telling you, like, I've been in their circles.
Yeah.
Nurses do more work than the doctors do.
Yeah.
I can't believe my mother is a nurse.
Oh, she is.
I never dreamt about being a nurse. Never in my world. So when you say that, like, wait, what's there?
Yeah.
What's the story behind you wanting to be a nurse? Okay.
I liked taking care of people. So when somebody was sick at home, I was always the one ferrying trays of tea and food. And my parents still instructed. Make fun of me to this day. No, but every time I would take food for that patient and they don't eat it, I would also always stay by their bedside, keeping them company, reading them stories or just talking. I talk.
How old
a lot
were
when
you
know
doing
me.
This?
Maybe four.
Wow.
Yeah, so then I always ate the food and hey. Slept in their bed, like just passed out.
Well, it's still helping at some point.
Yeah,
the person is not alone. Okay,
I
you
like
refuse the food, let me eat
people.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Could you have, but then you're saying at the age of four years, you can't really trace back when, what could have inspired this. So.
I might actually, I've done mm-hmm. a lot of self-reflection the last 2 years. I've been on sabbatical since I got sick.
Yeah.
I've thought about pretty much everything under the sun. Mm-hmm. 24 hours a day, no work. I used to work 18 hour days. So you can imagine doing nothing but dedicating myself to thinking.
Yeah.
From morning.
Yeah.
To the time I go
to bed. It's a lot of work.
So I've traced some of these things back, you know, asking questions about who I am and where I formed.
Yeah.
And what some of the things I know came from. Coming to so many epiphanies and realizations. So I did trace back and I realized even as a very young child that when everybody was happy and they were well looked after, then I was happy because there was laughter on the dinner table and my family has the greatest sense of humor. We are always laughing about the most random things. So I liked saying that. But I realized when somebody wasn't well looked after, they weren't part of the banter or the laughter. So I knew if we looked after everyone and just had each other's backs, then everybody would be happy, and that would make me so happy.
Oh, wow. Do you fall in the category of the ones that are called empaths?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a very sensitive person. I feel things, I think, more deeply than other people do.
Yeah.
But also, I tend to think that most people who end up with mental health problems are the sensitive ones.
Because they absorb a lot of energy, man. A lot. That's a lot. Because you just see the person there and you're, why are you sad?
You can feel all that pain.
Yeah.
You know, you sort of become a sponge that takes pain away from other people.
Mm-hmm.
You make everyone feel better, and then you carry all of that on your shoulders.
Mm.
Eventually, it's bound to break you.
It is, because it's a lot of burden.
Yeah.
You can't absorb every other person. It's one of those
questions
that I usually ask the practitioners in the mental space.
Yeah.
Mental health space. Like, how you take care of yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's very many stories that I absorb.
Yeah.
Because I'm not necessarily a practitioner in this, but I have people that reach out and,
But I believe everybody was put on this universe for a purpose.
For a purpose.
God doesn't make mistakes.
I read that yesterday.
Yeah, somewhere. So everybody has a role that they're meant to play, and then you're naturally equipped
naturally
to handle things that you're on earth to do a little bit more than people who aren't. So I consider myself a healer. I believe it's the reason I wanted to be a nurse even as a little girl. And that means that I have a greater capacity to heal and to take on pain than most other people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like a sacrifice you do. It's a service that you do for humanity.
Service.
And you
service.
Know, giving back to a world that has given you so much, but also looking back and seeing all the pain around, the psychological anguish and agony, and just knowing you can do something about it.
And then
you just do whatever little you can.
So here you are. How long did the dream of being a nurse take?
Not very long.
When did you?
So when I was 8 years old, my father put us in boarding school. He was raising us, my sister and I, while other siblings were in boarding school.
Yeah.
And then my mother, we had a farm kilometers away. So my mother was at the farm looking after that and with the younger kids. So my father was pretty much a single dad at home in Masaka, raising
wait,
two daughters.
So, wow, wait. So your mother was out there doing the economic bit?
The farm. Growing the food and tending to the cattle. We had a ranch.
Wasn't it economical?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So your mother was there tending to the economical bit. Mm-hmm. And your father was back at home, taking care of the children.
But also he was a magistrate and he was working at the court just very close to where we went to school. So it made sense that he keeps the kids who are going to school in the city while mom was back home growing the food and looking
after
the cattle.
It's not a common story.
We are cattle people.
It's not a common story.
Yeah.
Usually they say, please go with the kids. It's not a common story. It's quite interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So, sorry, I lost the
when you went to the boarding school.
Yeah, so then when we were old enough to go to boarding school, Dad took us to boarding school.
Yeah.
And I got into debating. I loved English. I loved comprehension.
Yeah.
I didn't like reading a lot, but I liked telling stories and writing. So I did a lot of that, and then it empowered me to speak to people and to build cases and make compelling arguments.
Look at that. That is girl.
Following in my father's footsteps,
exactly.
Suddenly I wanted to be a lawyer because I knew I'd be good at it. I was very good at shutting people down during debate. Like overriding an argument very strongly.
Yeah. And that was at the age of 8.
And this was at the age of 8. Mm-hmm. And so we used to do debating with our teachers. And I remember one time we had a showdown, my teacher and I, until he sat. And the whole
you would
class
debate
was
with teachers.
It was amazing. I was in Bread Grammar. It was the school that that really formed me. We had a lot of fun.
Masaka has quite a couple of products from Bread Grammar.
Really?
Yeah. I've had a couple of them.
It was pretty much the best school in the town at the time.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
You see, this is nice because with the way how adults have fragile egos, they wouldn't want to involve themselves with kids.
With 8-year-olds.
How are you as an 8-year-old defeating a possibly...
Well, those teachers, those very teachers had trained us well.
Then they're good.
Yeah,
they're good with the training.
Teachers.
They make you confident in yourself. Mm-hmm. You can even stand up to an adult.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but also growing up with a magistrate dad, our home operated like a courtroom. You still had to have a good argument or you're getting shut down. And it was a family of nine, so either you had a strong argument and could articulate yourself well, or everybody else won't listen to you and they'll listen to somebody else. So there's that competition even just for the attention at the table.
Boy.
During supper when you're sharing about how your day was. So, you know, you better speak up so the whole living room can hear you. It's a big living room.
So this is training
15
both.
Or so people.
That's huge.
Yeah.
Straight training from home back to school. So it's great.
Yeah.
Because most times you may find that a child is vocal in their homes, but then they get into a school that shuts them down.
Mm.
And I think that really happens a lot, especially for boarding schools, by the way, where the parent isn't, a lot happens. So again, so from, you know, nursing to lawyering, where are we now?
Now we are to teaching.
To teaching.
I've realized that I love to teach. So that talking nonstop as a child and even as an adult when I'm in comfortable situations.
Yeah.
Just showed me that I'm always explaining a point or sharing about something I've recently learned, some information I've acquired, either, you know, from a person or on TV or reading or wherever. So I realized I don't just talk, I'm teaching.
Yeah.
Usually I'm lecturing about something.
Yeah.
So then, but also I've been lucky to have a very successful career young. I'm 28 and I have 10 years of experience. I started working at 18. And during that time, I haven't done any small job. I've been lucky to work in high-paced and large environments. I've worked under the mentorship of some of the greatest commanders that you can imagine in Africa, with 15 armies in AMISOM. It's been incredible getting training from the military for 7 years
as far as discipline goes
and grit.
How do you end up in the military?
It's so after I wanted to be a lawyer, then I wanted to be other things, and journalist was one of them.
Journalism was one of them?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wanted to be a journalist too.
For the storytelling?
For the storytelling, also inspired by my father, who always watched the news with us. Yeah, he watched international news.
Yeah.
Pretty much all the time. And he sat with us while he did it. And he always told us, I want to see you anchoring on Al Jazeera one day. So I grew up knowing Daddy has to watch me from his seat.
Yeah.
And then when a job offer came up to work for the UN and the African Union in Somalia, it felt like the perfect opportunity to go and be close to CNN and Al Jazeera journalists who were coming to cover the hostile environment there.
Yeah.
So I went and I started doing military communications. I was 19 at the time. My journey
straight from secondary school.
Yeah, I was in my first semester at uni when I got the job. So I abandoned school and went to serve.
What did your parents feel about this?
I didn't tell them until I left. My dad wouldn't have allowed me. He still had the traditional understanding of the army, that the army is a cruel place where people die.
I mean, I think everyone has that. We're seeing people dying all the time.
It's true. Mm-hmm. We lose so many lives. Gallant soldiers die. But also the modern military today is involved a lot in diplomacy and building peace and reconstructing cities that have been torn apart by war.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work that doesn't actually involve being in a trench holding a gun and shooting people. So the military is saving lives and putting entire communities back together.
Because for the most part, we would imagine
killing people.
Okay, you know, we wouldn't imagine you killing them, but we would imagine you're on a battleground.
Yeah.
You know, that's what, when someone hears the word military, definitely they know you've been with a gun.
Of biowarfare and cyber attacks. Modern warfare is quite different. The bloodshed that we used to know is increasingly fizzing out. People are fighting differently now.
How exactly?
Using things like COVID.
Oops. Okay.
Bioweapons like that. Yeah. So the world is changing, and the military is increasingly having to confront evolving problems, which is why it has to be a very innovative machinery. It's a very fast-paced environment. You're always looking for new ways to solve problems faster and more efficiently.
Yeah.
It really, really grooms you, especially when you're working under the pressure of understanding that if I don't do my job well, people will die.
Right.
That puts things on a completely different perspective. If I don't do this well, people will die.
Right.
Yeah, right. So you wake up every day knowing that you have to give your absolute best. You have to go above and beyond. You have to constantly be thinking about how to confront problems as efficiently, as effectively as possible.
Yeah. It makes you cognizant of your environment.
Yeah.
It's not just about you. Like, for everything that you're doing, you have to think about the other person.
It's a life of service, and it's service that, where the ultimate sacrifice is life and blood, you know, you die. So it also teaches you, as you say, to look after each other.
Yeah.
It teaches you about solidarity and brotherhood and just knowing that you have to have your team's back, your brother's back, you know,
in the trenches together.
Either you're doing this or you perish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in the beginning, you talked about how you took a sabbatical when you got sick. Would you love to take us through the sickness?
I started getting sick in Somalia I'd been serving for 3 years at the time.
That was until the age of 22 or 21?
22, I was back here working with the UPDF locally.
Yeah.
At 23 as well, I was here, and then I went back at 24. So I did two tours, but then the first one was 1 year, mm-hmm. and then the other was 4 years.
Yeah.
But there were 2 years in the middle where I did other work.
Mm.
Yeah, I started getting sick at work around 2018. The first time was a depression. We had a climate disaster that was happening in Somalia. Also, a friend of mine had just died.
Yeah.
It was a friend of a friend. I didn't know them. It wasn't a one-degree connection. It was a second-degree connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they were electrocuted, and then they died. They were cleaning their house.
Yeah.
Got electrocuted and died. So it was a death that was so nonsensical like that. Like,
yeah.
You know, you were just mopping your house and you died.
Mm,
it didn't make any sense. So it affected me. The senselessness of death started to haunt me, and then I couldn't stop thinking about it, especially being in a place where people were dying every day.
Yeah.
I'd had a lot of experience with death, and it was heavy on me.
Mm.
So when the climate disaster started, it was cyclones at the time, it rained heavily, and our rooms got flooded at the military base. And then I had an extension on the floor.
Oh.
So when I woke up in the middle of the night and found my room was flooded and there was electricity on the floor, I freaked. I'm like, this is how I die. I freaked.
You just got the story and now it seems to be happening in your life too.
So I was too shaken from that. Nothing happened, thankfully. We had a good camp manager who, you know, started doing tours immediately, rounds immediately, and made sure everybody was safe in their rooms and mm-hmm. cleared the water and repaired the roofs and all that. But I didn't recover from that. I remained on edge constantly, just waiting. And then in Somalia, you had bullets pretty much every
hour. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it was very traumatic. So I couldn't work much longer after that. I sank into a dark depression. The work environment was supportive enough that they granted me time off to go home and just recover.
So you told them what had happened?
Yeah, I told them I was on edge. I couldn't function.
Yeah.
I needed time.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave me 6 weeks off. I came home to recover. I knew I had to go back to work. My career was the best that it had ever been. I was rising, getting promoted. I just made head of department.
Oh, yeah?
And I'd become a young manager. So I couldn't afford to be off work for a long time. I had to pretty much snap myself out of it, put myself back together and get back out there. And I remember a friend at the time, someone that I was seeing, kept telling me that I needed to make time to deal with everything that was happening, or else, you know, I would have a serious mental breakdown if I didn't slow down.
How old was that?
And I remember saying to him, I was 25.
Mm-hmm.
I said to him, I didn't have the time to take time out. I didn't even have the time to be sick. I had a lot to do.
I don't have time to be sick.
No.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot to be doing as far as my career growth went, and I was very focused and tunnel vision that nothing else mattered.
Yeah, apart from your work.
Apart from my work. So it wasn't long. I didn't ever recover mm-hmm. after that. That was the first time I ever was in a depression. And then after that, I made a career switch. As soon as I made HOD in about 6 months, another company had picked me up, got a big job offer to move to Botswana. I couldn't turn it down. Like, being sick just has to wait.
It has to wait.
It must.
And you know, this happens a lot. In this
we're
age.
Very good at keeping on.
Yeah.
Even when we're falling apart internally.
Let's go back a little bit. In the 6 weeks, did you seek any kind of professional help?
I tried.
Were you aware of where to find it?
Yeah, I was. Mental health is something that I'd been paying attention to previously for about 2 years. I'd been studying
before
psychology.
Then? Yeah. Oh, psychology. Right, right.
So I knew a lot about mental health.
Mm.
But when I tried to get in touch with people who could help, I didn't feel I connected with any of them enough for trust to be established.
Mm.
My problems were so personal.
Yeah.
That I had to be very specific who I shared with them about. So I preferred to self-medicate.
Yeah.
Not medicate with drugs. Self-medicate with self-delivered therapy.
Yeah.
I would go online, read more of the psychology that I was already reading previously for leisure, and then come and do what they said would help. It was more of self-care. Google has all the answers, even for mental health.
It does.
A lot of the answers can be got from there.
It does.
As long as, you know, somebody is not in crisis, that they need a psychiatrist to step in. Some of the psychology work can be self-delivered.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I started.
And I think 6 weeks is too short.
6 weeks.
To really figure out.
Too short to unpack 25 years of a matted mess, quite honestly.
Mm.
Yeah.
So you moved to Botswana immediately after?
So I moved to Botswana. At the time, my relationship had just ended. So I was dealing with that as well. I'm moving to a new country, leaving all my friends and family behind, my support system. And I was going through a bitter breakup that affected me very badly. And then COVID came.
Right.
And around the time COVID came was the time when I couldn't go on any longer. So I had got PTSD from my time in Somalia.
Mm.
After I didn't have military training when I went to the war. At 19, I was just
so young.
An excited young aspiring journalist.
Don't they put that into consideration when taking people on?
They probably should.
Mm-hmm.
But I was glad that they allowed me to contribute.
Exactly.
Because the work that I did there is work that I'm more proud of than any other work that
and
I
you
have
kept
done,
going through ranks.
Army.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It was incredible. So I'm really glad that they allowed me the opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, I didn't have military training and I was quite young. I had a lot to figure out in life. And so it was almost inevitable that I couldn't take it for so long. A lot of the army served for 1 year and then they come out.
Yeah.
I did 5 years. It was heavy. So it was inevitable.
Without training, 5 years, it's a long time.
Yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm.
So I crashed.
Yeah. When COVID hit,
when
it was
COVID
too much.
Hit, it coincided. And by the time of the lockdown, I was looking for mental help. I was trying all the hospitals that I could.
Yeah.
And I was just failing to find the help I needed.
Mm-hmm.
It was tough. It was tough when you realize the system that you should bank on when you're most vulnerable is actually life-threatening. There were points there when I felt like I was legitimately going to die.
Yeah.
Not that I cared because I was trying to die. I was extremely suicidal.
Mm-hmm,
so I was looking for anything to kill me, and the mental health system nearly did.
Help us understand how this mental health system did. Nearly
one.
Helped you go through with the suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Sadly, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The most unfortunate bit was getting locked up by people who have become so capitalistic that they've found a way to capitalize on people's most fragile and most vulnerable moments to make a buck.
Yeah.
And so there are all these small rehab centers that have cropped up in Uganda, unregulated.
Unregulated.
Unregulated, and I suppose even unlicensed. Just sprouting up, purporting to offer services with no programs, no trained professionals, just a place with walls where they can hold people and slap a signpost that says retreat center
rehab.
Or rehabilitation center.
Yeah.
So I was unfortunate to get caught in the claws of that mafia. And I suppose when they understood my background and figured they could make some money, they imagined this is somebody that they can't afford to lose. So they did whatever it took to just keep me. And they kept me for
62 days. I feel like that's even
dangerous.
I mean, when you see someone's background and you're doing some things, you know this is a ticking bomb.
Yeah, they should have known better.
Let me
but
tell
I
you
didn't
what,
know.
Let me tell you what's what's strange. There's a time when I Googled your name.
Yeah.
And that center popped up.
Yeah.
As the first thing. It's not your story. It was the center and showing directions. It's like, okay. So this is now the reference point to this place. Somewhere in June or July, I don't know if you saw the story of the mother who lost her son.
In Butarika.
Yeah. And previously, for some people that I've had on set discussing mental health, Butarika is one of the places that they referred people to. Like, this is a place that is good.
I've been there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was your experience?
My experience was both bad and good.
Uh-huh.
I had a nasty experience the first time I went there. It was during the lockdown, and they denied me admittance, and it got violent.
It got violent?
Yeah, so I don't disagree that there have been people in Butarika who behave unprofessionally and that can risk somebody's life. But then the second time that I went there, I found good people who gave me all the care that I needed and treated me
really
well.
How did you manage to go back?
I know it's the biggest mental health center that
yeah.
we have. For
mm-hmm.
anybody who's looking for help, you'd be a fool not to go to Butarika. It's
mm-hmm.
where all the government funding for mental health goes. So it's the small inefficiencies and errors that we need to correct, but at the end of the day, it's our biggest investment in mental health.
Yeah.
We just have to correct it.
Because
it doesn't have an option but to work.
Because I would imagine when you have a nasty experience for the first time,
yeah.
I feel like it would be hard for someone to even reconsider
yeah.
going back. What could have inspired you to go back?
Like I said,
mm-hmm.
you'd be a fool not to go to Butarika when you're looking for mental health support.
Really?
Yeah.
And for your second visit, everything was fine?
Yeah. Everything was absolutely fine.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, every place there are bad apples and there are things that don't work well. And it's upon the management to correct those errors.
Yeah. For you,
but also for people to keep pushing for these things to be corrected, yeah, because we have a lot of say as consumers, we can make or break our place,
So, you know,
for people to understand that they have that advocacy power and to use it to get the services that they deserve and they pay for because it's your taxes that are funding these places.
Oh, it is your taxes that are funding these places.
You are funding.
I don't even
these
think
places.
They know that. I don't think we know that. that is an interesting way to look at Butarika.
Mm.
I've known Butarika for the longest time. I mean, from childhood I would hear Butarika because mom used to go there for rounds.
Mm.
They do that in the trainings as nurses. So I knew Butarika. To date, I don't know where it's located.
Yeah.
I've never gone there, but I just knew its existence.
Mm.
And when someone referred to it, I was like, well, these guys have been in practice for a long time, more than two decades. So for your experience with the sickness, where are you at?
With my experience, sorry, repeat
The experience with the mental health and wellness.
Yeah.
Where do you
So that's mental health is something that you treat permanently pretty much for the rest of your life.
Mm,
but also understanding that just because some people end up with diagnosable mental illnesses doesn't mean that other people are okay too. So I encourage this self, at least the self-care for everyone.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information online about how you can cope with the psychological and emotional struggles that you go through.
Mm, mm,
so things like self-esteem,
yeah.
alcohol addictions,
yeah.
Angry personalities,
mm.
Insecurities, anxiety,
yeah.
panic attacks. I see a lot of people talking about panic attacks these days. There's a lot of information out there that can help you recover.
Mm.
And I'm on that journey. It's a journey that continues for all of your life, the same way that you look after your teeth or your heart or the rest of your body,
yeah.
or your eyes. It's the same way that you should look after your mind,
mm-hmm.
especially understanding that it's the most vital organ of your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What is that thing that you feel like we misunderstand about mental health?
I think the idea that just because you don't have bipolar or PTSD or schizophrenia,
mm-hmm.
that you're okay. I think so many people are not okay. I think so many people have been through so much from
yeah,
childhood.
Yeah.
That so many of us are dealing with trauma that we don't even realize that manifests in the way that we behave with other people.
Mm.
That we all really need to check ourselves and just think about what we consider to be mental health.
Yeah.
You're not mentally healthy when you're anxious all the time. You're not mentally healthy when you're depressed.
Mm.
You're not mentally healthy when you're always unhappy
yeah.
with yourself. If
mm-hmm.
you have a harsh self-critic, you're not mentally healthy. So don't wait for a doctor to give you a name for the thing that's ailing you or
mm-hmm.
that you're struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
You already know the problems that you struggle with emotionally and psychologically. So just proactively deal with them
yeah.
and look after yourself.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about, that has taken me to where you went through a journey, is it for 2 years, of self-reflection, I'll call it, and you came to a place of awareness to
yeah.
a point of even changing your name. Can you... Is that something that you could have picked off the internet, that you had to get into a place of awareness of self and understanding the things that you do or why you do them?
So when I started studying psychology,
mm-hmm.
I started to become aware of what psychological problems are, and I started to understand that, oh shit, I have issues
there.
And you're like, I have issues. You watch a video and it's about social anxiety, the fact that you make plans and always cancel them last minute because you don't feel like you want to go anymore,
or you're feeling
nervous about the meeting, or wondering what will we even talk about, and you don't understand that that's social anxiety. You just don't have the name for it, but there's something out there that
defines it.
That is happening inside you and
mm-hmm.
that you're not dealing with. So to answer your question about whether I got these things from the internet, it's yes and no.
Okay.
It's because self-awareness is a very internal process.
Mm,
and whereas you can be guided by the internet or people who have done it before, it's something that you have to do very personally. The self-reflection and the remembering where you've come from and just going back to the beginning and unpacking the things that you've learned and picked up from the world is something that has to happen very personally. But then also when you begin to expand your informational base about what psychological and mental wellness is, you start to realize you actually have issues and that you'd be much happier if you dealt with them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
How easy was this journey of you going back as far as the age of four?
It wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't easy at
mm-hmm.
all.
Mm-hmm.
Therapy, that was self-delivered therapy, but it's therapy nonetheless. And therapy is such a brutal process.
Brutal process.
It's something
process.
That is not for the faint-hearted. It's therapy is for the brave. Just going back and remembering things, but your mind has switched off. Your mind switched them off for a reason. It's because it couldn't handle them, or it was trying to protect you from dealing with them. From the consequences of them. So just going back and prodding and probing into all these old wounds and scratching the scabs. And like, what are you looking for, man? But then it's a process that's well worth it, because the moment you shed off all this skin from the conditioning that has happened to you through life, for me it was 25 years of living, you start to realize that actually finding who you really are, finding your true self and knowing yourself is well worth the agony of therapy, of trying to go back to the beginning and remembering it all.
Yeah. You know, you spoke to... What you're talking about speaks to what happened to me last year. I was preparing content for suicide prevention awareness. And I asked myself, why am I in this space of mental health? How did I end up here? So I started going years back, 1 year back, two years. I knew I wasn't well. And then there was a time that I couldn't really understand until I got to the age of 16 and I realized I had been placed with a psychiatrist.
Yeah,
she was a psychiatrist. And I was like, wait a minute. And now I started following up where it all started. I knew what was affecting me, but in that moment, in those years, I was more silent. I was all about who is not okay. Those are the people that I was looking out for, but I didn't know how to even look out for myself. So I fell into a place of crisis. The doctors and my mom realized, they didn't tell me. I got medication because I got something. I got affected to a point of, did they say oxygen wasn't getting to my brain? But it was something that wasn't direct. It seemed to be something secretive in that moment. I really have to sit down and ask her, what happened in this moment? And then, because that happened, the diagnosis happened mid of the term. So I went back to school with medication. That is the first medication in my life that I took without really, really knowing what it's about. Because as an asthmatic and various ailments, I know this is for my asthma, this is for my conjunctivitis, this is for these, this is for these. That medicine, I don't even remember the name. Maybe they didn't even name it, those guys. So in the holidays, I got placed with a psychiatrist. I knew it. I knew I had met a psychiatrist, but I had never gone to as far as why. And then I remembered how harsh this person was. Because she didn't even get to, I don't know, I think she didn't do the work right.
Yeah.
I didn't open up to her and she was dismissive. I didn't understand that. Because she was like, stop wasting your mother's money, focus on school.
Are you serious?
Yeah, focus on school.
Psychiatrist.
Yeah. And in my head I'm like,
wow,
what is going on? Because they just told me, whenever you want to talk to someone, talk to her. So I mean, in my head, I'm thinking, I've gotten a new friend.
Yeah.
I didn't know I had a problem.
Yeah.
But now this came to birthing last year. And I was like, what happened there? I think that's the deepest crisis I ever fell into. That was so bad.
Yeah.
Because everything started unraveling in a very terrible way. Everything just stopped making sense. I looked for her. I looked for her on the internet because I know both of her names. She wasn't anywhere. I was like, okay, now what next? I was lucky in that moment I got placed with a therapist, and that's what helped me, you know? So when you talk about how harsh it is to date back the beginning of some things, boy.
It's layers and layers of agony.
Terrible.
Yeah.
What can you leave with us for the listeners, for the most part, related to mental health?
I would encourage people to build very close circles of friends. and begin the critical journey of reparenting themselves. The truth is, we've had a bad parenting epidemic for a while.
Children are no longer getting the care
that they need and the upbringing that they deserve in their homes or in their schools. And a lot of things went wrong while we were growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Some of us lost parents when we were young and we were not supported through grief. Some of us were thrown out of our homes after our parents passing. Some of us had issues at school where we witnessed maybe the suicides of friends and loved ones. Yeah, while we were quite young. Some of us were sexually abused as children.
Some of us were beaten
into a pulp as children for the mistakes of children that really shouldn't have been punished for to that degree.
Mm-hmm.
A lot went wrong while we were growing up.
Yeah.
And I think that we have a responsibility as educated adults. Our generation is the first pretty much fully educated generation in the world. We have all the technology that we do at our disposal. We are connected at an unprecedented level.
Yeah.
An unprecedented level today than we, you know, ever before. And we have all these resources that we haven't had before, that people before us did not have, including the mental health professional help that we have available to us.
Mm-hmm.
We need to organize mental health solutions because the truth is we are struggling a lot and it's affecting us at work and at home. It's affecting the way that we form relationships with other people. So before we are getting married now and before we start failing at these marriages because of sexual problems that we have as a result of traumas that we haven't dealt with, bad financial decisions, or just not being good enough parents, before we start struggling with all these things and paying for the consequences of them, we really need to start healing ourselves. And the best way to do that is to find people who care about you, people that you can trust, people that have been through a similar journey as you have.
And just
beginning to speak honestly about the ways in which we've struggled. The more we speak about it, the more we remove the power that it has. But also psychologically, even the work of a therapist is to walk you back through the traumas that happened in your life, because now as an adult, you're better equipped to deal with them emotionally. And when you deal with them, then you rectify the behaviors that are coming out of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we need to do the process of psychotherapy for ourselves by listening to ourselves more and just sharing about the ways that we've struggled in a place of love and trust and support.
Mm-hmm.
And then after we've identified those issues that we have and acknowledged that we have issues, and that we need to be dealing with them, we need to know that there is help out there on the internet. You can find answers to all those problems with single clicks on your phone or your computer.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody is struggling and they can't find the information that they need, I guarantee them that they can call me, because it's all out there, I tell you.
This is very kind of you. Yeah.
We need to heal. We need to do something that we haven't done before.
Yeah.
Because we are suffering to a degree that we've never suffered before.
Mm-hmm. I feel you pointed at something, how we're struggling as adults.
Yeah.
And I keep saying this, okay, not too many people, just a few of them, that we are a manifestation of our childhood.
Yeah.
But we are not even aware of this. You know, we don't know these things.
Mm.
I mean, you're going to see someone who easily snaps, you know, and then you tell them, no, you can't do that. They're like, no, I'm like that.
Yeah.
No, you're not like that. Something made you like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And you can correct it.
You can correct it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. So do we get your contact details? Does someone get to call you? Like you said, someone can call you. How do they get in contact with you?
They can just send me a message on my Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My name's on Facebook, Alvaro Njiwe Isayo.
Yeah. All right, thank you so much.
Or they can send me an email at missbuiza@gmail.com.
missbuiza@gmail.com.
Yeah, they can also try out a program that I've started to help people that we call the Five Pillars Program. It's online, just Google it, the Five Pillars Program of Ranjibu Rusayo, you'll see it. Or you can check it out on my Facebook as well.
It's a program
that helps people organize their lives along five foundational areas we consider to be fundamental to somebody living a full and balanced and happy life.
Yeah.
These pillars are number one in order of priority and importance: health and wellness, love and belonging, financial freedom, contribution, that's work, academic or community contribution.
Yeah.
And then the last one is spirituality.
Spirituality.
What is your relationship with life and the universe? So what do you believe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's something that I wanted to ask you from the start, but it's a good thing that you mentioned spirituality.
Mm.
In this moment of crisis, what did your relationship with God look like?
I didn't have a relationship with God
in that
moment of crisis, and for many years before that.
Yeah.
I didn't believe in a God who could kill children like I had seen him do in Somalia and Syria and the other hostile environments that I'd been working in through my military career. So my relationship with God was that. I thought he was a haunting God who just relished in our misery and played puzzle games with life and people. Yeah, but then increasingly I came to understand God and life. Just understanding that the world has, everything has two sides, negative and positive, black and white, yin and yang, good and bad.
Mm-hmm.
So even for life and for God and for the world, there's bound to be a negative side of life, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
And I suppose, in a way, as the universe dictates for itself, there's nothing that God can do about it. Or, you know, the universe just has to balance itself out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it does. It's the way it is. And it's the reason that there are people like healers to try and alleviate that suffering.
Yeah. The healer that you are.
Yes.
Because I've seen you talk about God a couple of times. Mm. What is in your bio? God something?
God intoxicated.
God intoxicated. There.
But that, with that I meant that God is a drunk God. He's an intoxicated God. Like, you have to be drunk for the world to be in the disarray that it is.
Excuse me.
That was from my previous understanding of God when I still bitterly criticized him before I came to the awareness that
how
life
did you even
is just
come?
Going to be negative and positive.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you come to love God?
I don't love God.
You don't love God?
I accept him.
You
There's a difference. I've come to accept that there is a higher power,
okay,
and a force of nature out there that humbles everything on earth. But I can't say I love him. Those are two different things.
Yeah.
Somebody that I accept and that I respect the existence of.
Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your story.
Thank you for having me.
It's a powerful take.
Thank you.
I've been talking about the purpose of healing since I don't know when, and it's so refreshing to be in conversation that emphasizes the same concept. Buiza embodies what it means to be intentional about healing, and my takeaway from this episode is that we need to heal. Heal yourself in your effort to move to your next best season. You can't cheat the process. Now, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm sure you have. I know you have. I know you know it already. But this is our 50th episode, yeah? I need to look for some gold confetti to celebrate this golden episode. Okay, I'm not really looking for it. I want you to look for it to also celebrate yourself. And man, we made it. we made it, you know? You made it possible for me to make it, and I really cannot find the words to express my excitement. This episode has asked me to show up no matter what, and I heeded the call. Consistency is all I needed to be able to serve you diligently, you know? Even when the second lockdown found me in a foreign country, I had to show up. Like, hey, it's been a marathon. It's not been easy. This for the two seasons. The other one was hard because I had imposter syndrome. This one was hard because I had to be consistent. Consistency is not cheap. This season, man, it traveled transborder, and you have been a part of the journey. We done did it. Oh, I feel exhausted. I need a massage. I need all those good things. This episode marks the end of season 2. And be sure that as I take a month's break, a lot more will be going on in preparation of our return for season 3. And before I run away from my break, I would like to let you know that we created a digital generosity basket, right? I don't know if all of you saw it, but some have, and they're dropping in some coins. So we created a digital generosity basket in which you can donate to this podcast. That is if you love the podcast, if it has served you anyway. So any amount to keep this podcast alive is very much needed. And the way you can get to the basket is get to your browser right now, or find a pen and write flutterwave.com. Flutterwave is FLUTTER and then wave, WAVE. flutterwave.com/pay/htnkpodcast. All of these letters are in small case. Go to flutterwave.com. Flutterwave is FLUTTERWAVE.com /pay/htnkpodcast. Any coin, 200 shillings, any amount, just to keep the podcast alive is very much appreciated. Thank you for tuning into another episode of Hashtag With Navuguzi Chiwanuka. If you loved what you heard, make sure you subscribe to Hashtag With Navuguzi Chiwanuka in your podcast platform of choice and share it with your friends. They need this virtual space the way how you need it. The way how you need it. Don't be selfish. Check it out with your friends. And also feel free to share your insights about what connected with you on social media, and be sure to tag us. We are at #NavuguziChiwanuka on Instagram and Facebook, and on Twitter our handle is at htnkpodcast. HTNK is caps lock for Twitter, and podcast is in small case, but it's all one word. You can also reach us on our email, htnkpodcast@gmail.com. For the email, all of it is in small case, htnkpodcast@gmail.com. Your reviews are welcome, your suggestions are welcome, and I really look forward to hearing from you. I was going to say catch you in the next episode, but no. Catch you in the next season, and when we open up, I want to hear about all that you did to start your healing journey. Until then, adios. Mm-hmm.